Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure you register, not for the conference, because you can't do that because it's sold out, but you can register for the live stream. You want to get that conference streaming on your tablet, on your cell phone, on your laptop. You want to do that that Apple Play and throw it on your smart TV, dim the lights, feel like you're right there at the conference, you know, turn the surround sound way up, you know, get as full a conference experience as you possibly can. You can do all of that for free just by clicking the link that says live stream, and you just throw your email address in there and we will send you a link. It costs you nothing. There's also a link in the show notes. It'll say HWSS live stream. Just click on that and you get taken care of. Chad, we ended last week in 2 Kings chapter 9. We have a new king.
Yeah, we've got a new king while we still have an old king. We got two kings. Yeah, which is
never good.
Yeah, you're not going to have two kings very long. I don't care what the situation is. If you have two kings, you will not have two kings for long, because one of them is no longer going to be a king because he's going to be dead.
Two kings seems like no king until one of those kings dies.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, that's all. Not in the way it works in the Bible, but in history as well.
That's what that, you
two
know.
Two heads. If you have two heads, one gets chopped off.
That's right. I mean, they even say this in sports. It's a very common saying in football, when there's a quarterback controversy and they can't decide who the quarterback is, and they say, "Oh, we're gonna just kind of play them both and stuff." And analysts will say, if a team has two quarterbacks, they have no quarterback.
There you go.
Until you pick one, like, you don't actually have one.
Yeah, same applies here. So from the divine perspective, of course, you only have one king because Yehu just got anointed as the prophet instructed, and as the prophet was instructed by God. But the other king doesn't realize that, but he's about to find out the hard way, the fatal way, we might say. So Yehu, however you want to say his name, J-E-H-U, is our guy. He has been a military leader up to this point, and he has just been anointed by a servant of Elisha the prophet, who is referred to as a madman. You know, the prophets, they did kind of have this reputation for not being your ordinary kind of folks. So he goes up to where Yehu's at with his comrades, calls Yehu away from everybody else, anoints him, and then skedaddles, takes off, runs away, because presumably he knows things are about to happen that he does not want to be present for. And then when Yehu comes back in, he tries to kind of blow the visit off, like it's no big deal, but his comrades are like, no, what happened? And he tells them, and that's the moment of decision for them. Are they going to rally around him, or are they going to rally around their other king and oppose Yehu? Well, they rally around their friend and they put their garments down, blow the trumpet, and say Yehu is king. So now we have to see what happens afterward. So 9:14, 2 Kings 9:14 kind of rehearses everything that has just happened. It says, thus Yehu, the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi, conspired against Joram. So Joram is this second king. And as we pointed out before, Joram is also called Jehoram. They're just alternative spellings for the same person. Now, Joram, with all Israel, had been on guard at Ramoth-Gilead against Hazael, king of Syria, but King Joram had returned to be healed in Jezreel of the wounds that the Syrians had given him when he fought with Hazael, king of Syria. All that's kind of in parentheses in your Bible. This is a way of, as it were, recapping everything that just happened. So the king of the north is Joram or Jehoram. He's been at this battle with the Syrians. He gets wounded in his chariot, and so he is healing of his wounds in a place called Jezreel. And now we're going to pick up the story to see what Yehu says to everybody else. He says, well, if this is your decision, if this is what you want to do, then here's what I am asking of you. Don't let anybody slip out of the city to go and tell the news in Jezreel. In other words, if you're actually going to support me as king in this coup that I'm about to begin, then don't let anybody out of the city, because if they do, they could go, of course, and warn Joram before we get there. So Yehu gets in his chariot, And he heads to Jezreel, where Joram, the second king, is healing of his wounds. And then we're also told in verse 16, reminded in verse 16, that the king from the south, so the king of Judah, a guy named Ahaziah, he is also there as well. These guys were going to battle together against Assyrians. So you've got everybody's coming together. You've got Yehu, who is the newly appointed king, the one who's going to be the sword of the Lord. You've got the erstwhile king of the north, Jehoram, who's wounded and healing. And you have Ahaziah. So you have three kings, basically. You have two kings of the north. You have the king of the south. They're all coming to this same place. Now, verse 17 introduces us to what happens when Yehu and his party of soldiers are approaching from the distance toward Jezreel. There's a guy in a watchtower, a watchman in a watchtower, and he sees this company of soldiers coming. So he hollers down and says, "Hey, I see a company coming." And the king, Joram, says, "Well, take a horseman and go out and meet them and basically ask if everything's okay. Literally, is it peace? Is it shalom?" That's just a typical idiomatic phrase in Hebrew that it means, is everything okay? So is it shalom? Is everything okay? Is it peace? So in other words, there's no suspicion at this point that this party that's coming up there is a war party. There's certainly no suspicion that Yehu is heading this group that's about to initiate a whole bloodbath. They're just asking, is everything okay? So this horseman goes out there, meets him, and says, "Hey, the king wants to know if everything is okay. Is it peace?" Yehu responds, "What do you have to do with peace? Turn around and ride behind me." This, you can pick it up in English. You can pick it up in Hebrew as well. There's a very there's a sharp edge to the tone here. He's kind of like, "Peace? What are you talking about? Shut up and get behind me." That's kind of the it's kind of the whole tone of this. So the guy on the horse is like, "Uh-oh, I guess looks like I better choose sides here. So I'm gonna get on Yehu's side." And that's exactly what he does. So the watchman reported, "Hey, the messenger reached these guys, but he's not coming back." So verse 19 tells us that he sent out a second horseman. And this, by the way, is that we see this pattern all over the Bible, not just in the Bible, but in other literature as well, where you'll have three things happening or three people experiencing something. And the first two people or the first two happenings are basically carbon copies of one another. And it's the third where you have things change up. So same thing that's going to happen here. When the second horseman gets out there, we have a repeat of the exact same thing that happened the first time. So he gets there, he says, "Hey, the king wants to know if everything's okay." And Yehu answers basically the same thing. "What do you have to do with peace? Turn around and ride behind me." And sure enough, that's exactly what happens. And the watchman who's watching all this go down says he reached them, but he's not coming back either. And then he adds this detail. So throughout this narrative, we feel like we're kind of getting to know Yehu a little bit better. Well, we're going to learn a little bit more about his driving personality there. Because the watchman adds, after the second horseman doesn't come back, he says, "Oh, and by the way, the driving is like the driving of Yehu, the son of Nimshi, because he drives furiously." In Hebrew, by the way, this word translated furiously is the same word translated earlier as madman. Like the prophet who came to anoint him. They're like, "What's that madman all about?" So you could also translate this that the watchman says, "From what I can tell, it's Yehu because I can tell by the way he's driving. He's driving like a madman. So that's got to be who this is."
He's very aggressive with the driving, huh?
Yeah, must have been. Yeah, aggressive. Driving really crazily fast. Whatever it was, he could tell by the way he drove his chariot as to what his identity was. So this kind of leads us up to the third. So the first two situations are basically the same. The messenger gets there. Yehu says what he says. The messenger joins the group. So Joram, the king, says, "Make ready." And so they made his chariot ready. So the king himself is going to go out there. A fatal mistake, of course. So Joram, the king of Israel, and he wasn't by himself, Ahaziah, the king of Judah. each of these guys, each of these two kings, one from the north, one from the south, they each mount their chariots, and together they go out to meet Yehu. And then we have this geographical detail added, which, of course, is theologically pregnant, because it says they met him where? Not just on the field, not just outside the city, but they met him at the property of Naboth the Jezreelite. So why is that full of meaning? Because, of course, if you have been listening for a while, you remember that Naboth the Jezreelite is the Naboth that owned the vineyard that Ahab coveted and that he wanted to buy. And Naboth says, no, I can't give up the property of my ancestors. And so what does Jezebel do, Ahab's wife? Jezebel arranges this whole scenario where Naboth is accused of blaspheming God and the king. Naboth is subsequently stoned to death, and then his property is seized by the crown. So that's where this is all going down. And the reason this is important is because then the prophet showed up and he announced a curse that was to befall the house of Ahab because of what they had done to Naboth. So if you know all that background, you know the fact that they're meeting at that very property where the blood of Naboth, the murdered victim, has soaked into the ground, and where this curse, impending curse, was pronounced, you know that something big is about to happen.
It's interesting, too, that it still refers to, I mean, Naboth is dead. I mean, he was stoned to death. But the author here still refers to this as his property.
Oh, yeah, that's good. That's a great point. That's right. Yeah. It doesn't say at the property of the king. It's the property of Naboth.
As far as God is concerned, this property belongs to Naboth.
Yeah, yeah. Reminds me of back in 2 Samuel, in the whole David, Bathsheba, Uriah thing. At some point, like after Uriah is dead, Bathsheba is still called the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Does Matthew 1 say that? Does Matthew 1 call Bathsheba the wife of the wife of Uriah? I think that's right.
I think it does.
I could be
wrong
about that. Yeah. Yeah. David. Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. And to David was born Solomon by her, the wife of Uriah.
Yeah.
Even after all that time, that's still how she's referred to. So, similar situation here. So we know things are about to get crazy here because of everybody coming together at the place where they do come together. So verse 22 says that when Joram saw Yehu, he said, kind of the same thing as the messenger said, "Is it peace, Yehu? Is everything okay?"
It's
here?
Not. It's not peace, dude. Like this response is like
this.
It's not
this. I mean, this burns bad.
Yeah. If you're gonna say it in less words, like, no, it's definitely not peace, but he says it differently than that.
He says it much more creatively.
It does.
Yeah. Yeah, he could have just simply said, nope.
Nope.
And then killed him. But that will not suffice for Yehu. He's got a response. He's got a pretty cutting response. This is one of those extremely memorable responses that we have in the Old Testament. So Joram comes out, and just by way of reminder, Joram is the son of Ahab and Jezebel. Okay. So he comes out and says, "Is it peace, Yehu? Is everything cool between us? Everything all right?" And Yehu answers him, "What peace can there be so long as the whorings and sorceries of your mother Jezebel are so many?"
Oh,
wow. I mean, I don't care when you live, where you live. I don't care about any of the details. If somebody calls your mom both a whore and a sorceress to your face,
yeah,
that's pretty sharp. Now,
so many whorings and sorceries.
In the plural, right? Whorings and sorceries of your mother Jezebel are so many. How can there be peace? What peace can there be so long as your mom is doing her whorings and her sorceries? Now, as readers of the Old Testament realize, Jezebel was not actually running a brothel. The whorings that are referred to here are all of the idolatries, which were were assisted by Jezebel, which were promulgated by Jezebel. I mean, she grew up as a worshiper of Baal and Asherah. That was just what her people did. And so when she married into the Israelite family, when she married Ahab, she just brought all that with her, just like all the wives of Solomon did. So she brings this in. And so, you know, as we know from many narratives, I mean, she was fierce. She was a zealous advocate for Baal and Asherah. She's the one who wanted to kill Elijah. That's the reason he fled all the way down to Horeb. She made that vow to end his life after he took out her prophets of Baal. So that's the whorings that she's been doing, all of this this rampant idolatry in the land. Sorceries is often connected with idolatry. If you go to Nahum chapter 3, verse 4, there's a reference to both those things being used there. Isaiah twice, and then Micah also mentions sorcery as a connection with idolatry. No details are given as to how this worked, but the basic idea is there. You're already enmeshed in the dark forces when you're engaged in idolatry. All these dark forces of evil would use idols as their front, and so sorceries would just kind of, you know, just throw in that as well along with your idolatry.
Yeah, you know, I mean, when you're talking about actual idols, not like we all have idols, but when you're talking about idols that are gods with other names, I mean, Paul will expressly says like this is the worship of demons, right? And that sounds like sorcery.
Yeah, precisely. It's different, right? I mean, if you think of money as an idol, okay, money is an idol, yeah. But if you're worshiping Baal, Asherah, Chemosh, I mean, all of these other idols of the ancient world, then what you're looking at is basically a mask for the demons.
Well, there are accidental idols, and by accident, I don't mean that you're without guilt for worshiping them, because to worship them, you have not, you know, loved and feared and trusted God above all things. But you would, that's different than actually carving something up, naming it a god, and then and bowing down to worship and saying outright, like, this is my god. You know, most people that worship money won't tell you that, and they're not trying to convert people to it. You know, that's not what they're, it's, you can, I mean, of course, we can identify things in our own lives and other people and say, this seems to be their god. They wouldn't say that. But Jezebel has no problem saying that these are her gods.
Yeah, this is not only explicit, but it is willful. This is exactly what she wants to do.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And I don't know what kind of reputation Jehu has as a guy. I'm not exactly sure. I'm assuming he has a reputation of someone who is not to be messed with, because typically when someone insults your mother in this way, if you're just dealing with like some guy, then you have to go and, you know, defend your mother's honor and all this kind of stuff. And this is the queen. So maybe these two guys need to get off their chariots and have it out right here. Not so. Joram is totally freaked out.
Yeah. He knows exactly what's happening.
And I mean,
so
like leave Jehu's lips and he is like on the run.
He's on the run. Yeah, it says he reined about. So, of course, he's in his chariot. So he turns that chariot around as fast as he can, takes off, yelling all the while he's doing this to the other king, to Ahaziah, "Treachery, Ahaziah." So, in other words, you better get out of here because I know this guy. He has the reputation, and violent things are about to happen right now. So if you like life, you better get out of here. Quick as possible. Turn your chariot around too. Whip it around. Get out of there.
It's not peace.
Not peace. Yeah. not shalom that's happening here. And are they going to get away? I guess we'll find out. Verse 24 says that Jehu drew his bow with his full strength and shot Joram between the shoulders so that the arrow pierced his heart and he sank in his chariot. So he shot him in the back. There was nothing chivalrous about this. There's nothing like, you know, they're going to have a good old-fashioned gentleman's duel here after he's insulted his mom. And Jehu is out there to take him out, period. And so he shoots him in the back. The guy falls down into his chariot, either dies immediately or dies shortly thereafter. So Jehu says to one of his sidekicks, a guy named Bidkar, kind of a cool name, Bidkar. He was said to Bidkar, his aide, take him up and throw him on the plot of ground belonging to Naboth the Jezreelite. So, of course, this is the Naboth we were just talking about. So, get his body. Evidently, his horse stopped, and they went to his chariot, picked up his body, and Bidkar is going to just toss him on this plot of ground. But Yehu has something else to add. This is a detail to which we were not privy. It was kind of, you know, it was saved for this moment, in fact. And once we hear this, we're like, oh, I see another little side here of Yehu's history. Because Yehu goes on to say to Bidkar, remember when you and I rode side by side behind Ahab, his father, and how the Lord made this pronouncement against him? That word pronouncement could also be translated oracle. So this is an official oracle, the pronouncement that the Lord made. That Yehu and Bidkar both heard when they were with Ahab. And he quotes, as surely as I saw the blood of Naboth and the blood of his sons, declares the Lord, I will repay you on this plot of ground. So that's what he remembers hearing. And then he goes on to say to Bidkar, so take him up, throw him on the plot of ground in accordance with the word of the Lord. So way back when Ahab, of course, with the help of Jezebel, she's really the one who orchestrated the whole thing. But when all this happened, it turns out that Yehu and Bidkar were around. They saw this happen. They knew what Ahab did to Naboth. They heard what the prophet said to the king. And now they're seeing that prophecy come to pass. And so they're going to leave his body unburied, which of course was not only a grave insult in the ancient world, but of course would be a grave insult today, just to kind of leave a body to rot on the ground. But that's what they're going to do. Now, another interesting detail that we have not heard before is when he says, quoting God, he says, as surely as I saw yesterday the blood of Naboth and the blood of his sons. Now, there was no mention whatsoever of the bloodshed of Naboth's sons back when this was recorded. So either they're kind of hamming up the story, or things happened that we were not told about. Naboth died, but the sons as well.
Yeah, perhaps Naboth, you know, was they were like, well, perhaps they said, we got to take out Naboth, but we got to take out those who would inherit this land as well. They just take out everybody.
Yeah, yeah. It's the old parable of the tenants, right?
Yeah.
Hey, there's the son. Look, there's the son. Let's kill him and the inheritance will be ours. You got to, yeah, if you're gonna steal an inheritance, you better make sure that you take out all the heirs as well.
Oh.
So it would make sense. I mean, that if they're going to kill one guy in cold blood, then why would they not also kill several people in cold blood if they were going to go that way?
You're also trying to limit any potential retaliation for such a thing too.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll see that in the next chapter that Yehu does the same thing with the whole any possible connection that somebody has to the house of Ahab. If you have that, chances are you're going to be dead pretty quick, because Yehu's going to either personally take you out or get somebody else to do that. But remember, back in this whole situation that's happening here, that you have another king. You've got Yehu, the new king, the usurper, not really usurper. He's the one that God sent to do this. So he's the new divinely appointed king. And Jehoram is now dead. His body's disposed. But you had another king. You had the king of the south, Ahaziah. What's going to happen to him? Well, he's not going to get away either. Because Ahaziah, when he sees all this happening, he takes off. He turns his chariot in the direction of a place called Bet Hagan, the house of Hagan. And Yehu pursued him and says, shoot him too. And they shot him in the chariot at the ascent of Gur, which is by Ibleam. He fled to Megiddo, so he didn't. He was just wounded, but he's able to make it to Megiddo. Megiddo is in the same area. So he had the Valley of Jezreel, which stretches from east to west. It connects the Mediterranean coast to the Jordan Valley. It's the most fertile part of Israel. And in the Valley of Jezreel, you have the city of Jezreel, but you also have Megiddo. So they're just a few miles apart. So he leaves from Jezreel, and he's wounded along the way, makes it all the way to Megiddo, but his wound was serious enough to where once he got to Megiddo, he died. Perished from his wound. And so he at least had a proper burial. We're told that his servants carried him in a chariot back southeast to Jerusalem. And there they buried him in the tomb with his fathers in the city of David. So unlike his northern counterpart, at least Ahaziah had a proper burial. Then we have this odd ending to this section. In the 11th year of Joram, the son of Ahab, Ahaziah began to reign over Judah. It seems like the verse seems kind of weirdly out of place because these are the guys we just talked about.
So it's like they forgot to put that part in, and so they throw on the end there. Should have opened with that. We'll end with it.
Yeah, well, there's a little space left on the scroll, so we'll add it at this point. So at this point anyway, Yehu has taken out two kings. He's on a roll here. He's taking out the king of the north, taking out the king of the south. Now, why would he take out the king of the south? Well, probably because this guy was teamed up with the northern king, and they were going to battle together. They're both related one to another, and the king of the south, by participating with this idolatrous king in the north, is also then going to face the same penalty that the king in the north also faced. So, if you have any connection whatsoever to Ahab's family, then your life's in danger. That's the general thrust of this whole narrative. Okay, now we're at verse 30, and we're going to hear about what happens to everybody's favorite female character in the Bible, Jezebel. So Yehu comes to Jezreel, and Jezebel hears about it. We don't know everything that she's heard, but she has certainly heard enough. One of this interesting detail added too, we're told that she painted her eyes and adorned her head and looked out the window as Yehu is pulling up in his chariot. Most commentators will say, and I think I have to agree at this point, that the narrator adds this point as a way of kind of throwing even more shade on Jezebel, because the act of painting her eyes is used elsewhere in the Old Testament for what a prostitute would do. So it kind of, you know, of course, it fits with the accusation that Yehu made earlier when he's talked about the whorings and the sorceries of Jezebel. And so here, true to that, she paints her eyes and adorned her head when she looked out the window at Yehu. And she's got her own little salty speech here for, yeah. If Yehu is, you know, has some sharp words to say about her, well, she's not at a loss for words herself. Yehu entered the gate, and as he goes into the city, she's looking down from her window. And by the way, this had to have been an upper story window, as we're going to find out in just a minute. This is not like she's on the bottom floor and she's opened a window and she sees him. She's I'm guessing, at least third floor up. This has to be a tall building because of what we'll hear in a moment. So she's looking down. As soon as Yehu comes in, she says, "Is it peace?" She used that same word there. "Is it peace?" Then she has this, "You Zimri, murderer of your master." Now, you know, like any insult, if you don't know the context, or if it's a certain idiom of a language, then you might not quite get it. But Zimri, you may recall, or may not, this is way back in 1 Kings chapter 16, so a few episodes ago, but Zimri was what one commentator calls the seven-day wonder. So Zimri was Zimri staged a coup. He killed a king, and then he reigned as king himself for a whopping 7 days before he himself was killed, taken out by Omri. Omri being the very founder of the dynasty of which Jezebel is now a part. So when she calls him a Zimri, she's saying, "Is it peace, you seven-day wonder? You're a murderer just like Zimri is." And of course, by implication, she's also saying, "And your reign will last just as long as Zimri's did." 7 yeah. days.
Yeah, you know you're someone special when your name just becomes an insult by itself.
Yeah. You have reached the level of infamy when your name becomes a proper insult to give to someone. So is it peace, you Zimri, murderer of your master? And Yehu he doesn't even respond directly to that. He looks up, sees her there at the window, and he says, who's on my side? Who?
By the way, this is like such a confident move to make.
Yeah. This is a chutzpah here. This is some brazen confidence.
Did you just know everything is going to go the way I want it to go? So that you get this, you know, she comes out with this big burn insult on you. And this is as good of a response, if it works out for you, as you could possibly have.
Yeah. Yeah. Anybody up there on my side? Anybody? Who? Anybody else? And then we're told that two or three eunuchs looked out at him. Eunuchs were very commonly in the ancient world court officials. So these are probably, you know, they're close to Jezebel. So they're obviously they're in the service of the crown. And you can see this whole scene. She's way up there. You know, she's taking this whole look about her. And she's given Yehu this tongue lashing. And all of a sudden, two or three other heads pop out. There's a face. There's a couple of faces. You can see. You got two or three eunuchs that hear Yehu and they look down at him. And his response is three words: throw her down. It's more confidence, right?
Yes.
Throw her down. And that is exactly what they did. So these two or three eunuchs who were looking down threw her down, grabbed her, and tossed her out the window. Not an unknown historical thing to happen. For the life of me now, I'm forgetting the situation, but there's a situation in history where the same thing happened to another official. So they throw him down. And this is the reason I said it had to be farther up than the first or second floor, because we're told that when she hit, some of her blood spattered on the wall and on the horses, and they trampled on her. So gruesome death, and her body is treated with basic contempt, just laying there in the street so that the horses trample on her.
Well, and you see this contempt, and just, dude, Jehu is just really feeling his oats here, too, because that happens, and then, I mean, verse 34 is just, then he went in and ate and drank.
Yeah, just doesn't care. Just goes right in, sits down, and starts to have his meal. Then it's some time, I guess, passes, and verse 35 says verse 34 says, he said, it's like he just kind of, he's like, oh, yeah, I just remembered what happened to Jezebel. So he says to some of his servants, see now this cursed woman and bury her, for she's a king's daughter. Now, that is an odd thing to say, only because he knows what exactly has been prophesied of her. So it's like he forgets temporarily what is actually to befall her body. But anyway, that's what he says. See to this cursed woman, bury her. Because after all, I mean, she does come from royalty. She is a king's daughter. Well, verse 35 says they went out to find her and to bury her. But they didn't find much to bury. They found no more of her than the skull and the feet and the palms of her hands. It's not much left. And they go back inside and they tell Yehu what happened. And he said, oh, this is the word of the Lord, which he spoke by his servant Elijah the Tishbite in the territory of Jezreel, the dogs shall eat the flesh of Jezebel, and the corpse of Jezebel shall be as dung on the face of the field in the territory of Jezreel, so that no one can say, this is Jezebel. That last phrase, no one can say this is Jezebel, probably means that, you know, there's not going to be like a grave or tomb of Jezebel where perhaps those who are still loyal to that line can, as it were, use as a rallying point. This, by the way, is not uncommon uncommon either. The when the last czar, when his family was murdered, the Bolsheviks destroyed the bodies so that they couldn't be found. And then if you read about the martyr Polycarp in the early church, the Romans destroyed his body, burned his body, specifically so that they could not have his body and bury his body and have that place as a have that grave as a meeting place to the Christians. So the total demolition of bodies and removal of them so they can't be buried is something that has happened probably many other times. And that's kind of what happens here with Jezebel. It's an insult to her. It's divine punishment that befalls her because of everything that she has done, so that in the end, even her body is not buried, but instead gets consumed by the wild dogs that roam the streets back then.
Yeah, you have to assume that it was been laying there for a second.
Yeah, for that.
Either that, or I don't know how many dogs there are and how hungry they are, but
must have been quite the pack. Yeah, yeah. It's as everyone realizes, this is a gruesome part of the story. But it's, you know, it's also the fulfillment of prophecy. It's a gruesome end often comes to those who engaged in gruesome acts during their life, and Jezebel certainly did. I mean, that's a reason that when still today, you know, if someone thinks of, even if they don't know the Bible, they know that Jezebel is not a good name.
Right.
Jezebel has, that too, unlike Zimri, who was known back then, nobody knows who Zimri is today, but people still do know who Jezebel is today. And she becomes so proverbially evil that Revelation mentions a Jezebel, right? So, yeah, this is one of those characters that is larger than life in a very negative sort of way.
Yeah, I mean, Jezebel is now, as much as, I mean, I suppose, you know, you look at this and you say Zimri is an insult just by saying the name. Jezebel says that to Jehu, but throughout history, Zimri, that one's been forgotten, but her name is an insult to this day.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, again, if people don't know the biblical story and they think about a Jezebel, most people associate that with someone who is sexually promiscuous. And that's interesting also changed, too, because, of course, in the biblical story, there's never any indication that Jezebel herself is an adulteress or sexually promiscuous or anything like that. Instead, what you have, of course, is her in engaging in and promulgating spiritual adultery.
Yeah.
By leading the Israelites into the worship of Baal, and Asherah.
Yeah, so, she's a hyper-idolater.
Yeah, that's right. That's a great way to think about it. She's a hyper-idolater who not only engaged in idolatry, I mean, of course, that's bad enough, but did everything. She's one of those few characters who, I mean, we have a lot of people who engage in idolatry in the Old Testament who are rulers, kings, and queens, but she takes things to the utmost extreme by also wanting to completely destroy any chance that someone has to be a worshiper of Yahweh.
Yeah, I think what sets her apart is not the fact that she worships false gods, which of course tons and tons of people do, but her opposition to God. You know, some of these other kings are like, you know, like, we're going to kind of like, you know, yeah, we're going to worship the Baals and stuff. I mean, if you want to worship Yahweh, I mean, whatever. Like, they're sort of this indifferent, and they just sort of have this, you know, they're more like have like this pantheon of gods, and they're just kind of letting whoever do whatever they want. Jezebel is like diametrically opposed to Yahweh.
Yeah, yeah. She's kind of like she would be the counterpart to someone who's like she's kind of a counterpart to Yehu, actually, because, you know, he's got this zeal, right? Zeal for the Lord. Well, she has zeal too. She has zeal for Baal. She has zeal for Asherah. So, I suppose you could call her as someone engaged in syncretism, but it's a very selective syncretism because she does not want Yahweh to be worshipped whatsoever. She destroys his prophets. She destroys his altar. She does everything that she can to annihilate that. And because of that, she ranks up there with the worst of the worst in the Old Testament because of what, not because of sexual promiscuity, but because of theological promiscuity. as well as persecution and murder of the Lord's prophets.
Yeah, that's right. And we will leave it right there. We are out of time. We will be back next week. Jehu's not done with his lack of peace. There's going to have to be a lot more bloodshed before maybe someone gets some peace around here. So we will be back next week to discuss that. Chad, I'll see you then.
All right, see you then.